Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldi. And this month we've got a fantastic article by Hannah Betts, who's been to the site of the legendary Troy to accompany a new exhibition at the British Museum on Troy, Myth and Reality. Now, Hannah, the extraordinary thing is, as you say in your piece, is a lot of people don't know that Troy actually exists.
No. In fact, I go into my piece saying it's the most incredible archaeological site in the world, least frequented by middle-class culture vultures. And I was very lucky. I talked to the Professor Rustem Aslan, who's the chief archaeologist and has been since 2013 and has given his whole life to the place. And he often hears people saying on their into their mobiles, "Yes, I'm at Troy, in Greece," which of course is exactly the point, that it's not in Greece, it's in Turkey. And the whole point is it's East meets West as a confrontation in the Iliad. But people remain confused about that issue.
And whereabouts in Turkey is it? Again, a lot of people won't know where it is.
No, it's the northwestern area near Çanakkale. Am I saying that right?
Çanakkale.
Çanakkale, yeah. There we are. I'm very English. Hissarlik? How do you say it?
Yeah, Hissarlik.
Hissarlik,
yeah.
Hill.
Yeah.
So it's about a four-hour drive from Istanbul.
Yeah, about 200 miles, 250 miles away from Istanbul. And so, first of all, people don't know that Troy, the site, exists. The other thing is whether the famous Trojan War actually happened.
Exactly.
Do you think it did happen?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And so does the good professor. So it's not just my wishful thinking. So we reckon that Homer, if one believes in Homer, visited in about 720 BC to write the Iliad in about 730 BC, sometime in the 8th century. And that he visited Troy 8, which I can explain in a minute, and that the late Bronze Age Troy is Troy 6 and 7, which would have been in the 1180s BC.
And I'm going to interrupt you there because already it'll be confusing for the majority of people who haven't been there. You refer to these Troy numbers because, as you say in your brilliant piece, Troy is like a series of flying biscuits laid on top of each other.
There is a very beautiful flying biscuit diagram that's very easily Googleable. So yes, we have Troy's 1 to about 11. And in fact, the professor has now been excavating in a Troy 0. So there are lots of different Troys.
Listeners get it. So the lower the number, the earlier down. So
yes.
Troy 0, this very exciting new discovery, is right by the bedrock. Back to, I think, 3000 BC, is it?
3600, I think he said.
Amazing.
So even if we didn't feel this were Troy, which we do, which it is, it would still be one of the most incredible archaeological sites in the world because it's been in continuous occupation for such a long time. And in fact, only after the 16th century AD did it kind of get forgotten, and then people started to think, oh no, but Homer's fictional, the war didn't happen, all these sorts of things. And then it got rediscovered in the Victorian period.
And so when do you and the great Professor Aslan think the Trojan War took place?
The consensus based on the archaeological evidence is the 1180s BC. And this has gradually been proven under both Professor Aslan and Professor Kaufman, who was his doctoral supervisor, who came before him. Various things have, over the years, more recently, helped to prove that this could be the late Bronze Age Troy. There's signs of a great conflagration, a burning down. Before that, there are signs that the walls were reinforced for a siege, that the west gate, which was vulnerable, was walled up. Another thing that Fox's visitors is that Homer describes Troy as being on the sea, and there's a lot of paleogeographical evidence that it was on the sea, but that the sea has now moved and is further away.
Does the evidence in Homer, in the Iliad, back it up, the site?
Yeah, I think when you and I were talking about it, you reminded me that Athena herself says that west wall was vulnerable. There are various other references, again, the geography. If you know the Iliad well, when you go to the site of Troy, you immediately feel moved by you know, this pretentious term, the kind of psychogeography. And, you know, if you sat there with your copy of the Iliad, you would be able to cross-reference to where you can see the ships, where you might see the fighting, where Priam would have stood with the women watching the fight, where Helen identifies the soldiers for him. All of that, you can actually sort of wander around and put yourself in the right position, which is incredible for those of us who did the Iliad at school and then find ourselves in the place where it happened, having so long been told it was fictional.
We've both been there. It's an incredible thrill, isn't it? But as you say in your lovely piece, Professor Aslan says a lot of people come and they're a bit disappointed because they're used to later classical ruin.
Yeah, and I think they don't realise quite how old it is. So if you come expecting it to look like Ephesus or Pergamon, you will be disappointed. It's and some people sort of say, oh my God, it's just a pile of rubble. You know, it's a windswept pile of rubble. Some of us rather like that. It's more evocative. But and one thing that's going to help people who were disappointed in it is this new 7.5 million pound museum that the professor's been very instrumental in setting up, which situates the site for you. It explains the site. It tells you about the different biscuits, the different layers, and reminds people of the myth, and then shows you the history of the archaeology, which in itself is really interesting.
Because the great hero come villain of Troy is Heinrich Schliemann, the German archaeologist who started excavating Troy in the 1870s. Is he a goodie or a baddie, and why?
Well, when I talked to the professor about this, he was very kind. He sort of generously said, oh, there's a good Schliemann and a bad Schliemann. I'm pretty much of the bad camp. He was a looter. He carried off so-called Priam's treasure. He basically knocked down anything he came across, literally using things like battering rams. On the other hand, without Schliemann, would we have rediscovered Troy? Maybe not. He was a great sort of publicist and PR man, and in a sense that's given us back Troy. So, I mean, it's something that will be debated. If you go to Berlin, the Germans, the archaeological museum there, the Berliners, the Germans, they have rehabilitated him. The British Museum, interestingly, actually rejected taking his treasures back in the 1870s. And in a sense, this new exhibition is then making up for that. Although actually, you know, I think that's probably Schliemann himself who would have done business with him. He felt a bit like a crook. But they were, some of these exhibits were on display at the V&A for 3 years. But this is the first time they'll have been back in London since the 1870s, I think.
And tell us the story of Priam's treasure, because it is very, very dramatic. As you say, Schliemann, by tearing apart Troy, did extraordinarily find this amazing treasure.
He did. It's a magnificent gold. Can't quite believe that it looks so incredible. It actually predates the Bronze Age. So the name Priam's treasure is wishful thinking on Schliemann's part, and again, part of his publicity machine. It comes from Troy, I think Troy 2 or Troy 3, so it's much earlier, more ancient. This sort of brilliant yellow gold. And then Schliemann carried it off, having decorated his young Greek wife in it. I say Greek, was she Turkish?
No, she's Greek.
She's Greek. Greek. Yeah, Sapphire, and yeah. He auditioned her, didn't he, with testing her on her Greek. So she also knew a lot of Homer. He decorated his wife in this very fetching, she looks, this famous picture. And then he took the treasure away. It went to Berlin. Then the Russians, when they invaded, took it to Russia. And then it turned up again.
In 1945.
Yes, yeah. In 1945. Yeah. And then it turned up again and is now exhibited in the Pushkin Museum.
It is an extraordinary.
And there are various replicas you can see.
But there are, I've been to the Troy Museum as well, and there are some fantastic things in the Troy Museum. I thought the most extraordinary thing was the tomb of Priam and Hecuba's daughter.
Yes, isn't it amazing? The sarcophagus. And actually, the professor rightly pointed out that even though between the 16th century and Schliemann, there's a sense in which Troy, that's the only period in which Troy gets lost to human occupation. Even then, there's a kind of memory in the geography. So the sarcophagus was found 110 kilometres, I think, from the centre. of the nearest city, and yet it was a place known as Dead Girl's Hill. And obviously it's an area we still refer to as the Troads. So even though we might Hislark Hill might have built up and we might have lost the various Troys for a period, it's still known in the area. It's still a kind of current geographical myth.
And one of the exciting things is you can see those layers, can't you? Not least, perhaps the most prominent one is the latest one, is the Roman lair, because Julius Caesar, like Alexander the Great, like Xerxes, and like later Constantine, all visited the site.
Yes, right? Yeah. It's any celebrity who was a celebrity in the ancient world went to have a look. And so one feels like the latest in a series of these heroic celebrities.
And then to go to the story of the Iliad, which you've loved since you were at school.
Yes.
Why is it such a fantastic story? A lot of people won't actually have read it, but they will know it's the sort of one of the founding blocks of Western European literature. Why is it so fantastic?
You know, it's funny. I decided I was an atheist aged 4 and could never have any truck with either the Old Testament God or the New Testament Jesus, and just felt that was always terribly fictional and Father Christmas type stuff. But somehow the story of the Iliad felt self-evidently right. And these are just people that we know. We've all met these types of people. We know these figures, Helen, Achilles, Agamemnon, Paris. We know them better than our own political leaders. We've kind of grown up with them. Our culture's grown up with them. We know, to beware of Greeks bearing gifts. We know that what begins with an apple must end with a horse. As the British Museum exhibition will show, these are the stories of our culture as much as the stories of Judaism or, you know, a Palestinian religious leader from far more recently. These are more ancient stories.
And do you think it's because they create those stories, or actually they just immediately tune in to innate human characteristics?
I think it's the latter. I think it's funny. I was thinking this morning about Beowulf, and if you read Beowulf, often they sound very remote, those heroes, and it doesn't feel, you know, they sound odd, Germanic, a bit weird, not kind of culturally resonant. When I read Helen's comments to Paris or to Hector, we all know women like that. We she feels very immediate. She doesn't feel like a Bronze Age figure in a bear skin or a leopard skin or whatever. She feels like a woman you've met in a nightclub or in a pub or in a bar, and immediately fascinating. None of that kind of oldie worldy language that we expect. You know this bird. You've got her number. And similarly, these are just people we know.
And going there, I found, I'm sure you found this, you can combine the two. So when I was there, I did think of that famous scene of Hector saying goodbye to his wife and his son before he goes off to fight on the plain below, which you can also see. And his wife famously laughs through her tears as he plays with the child and goes off to fight. And so you can, without it being naff, you can completely ally the story with reality, can't you?
Yes, very much so. And yes, that child is in my mind as well, because then there are the various stories about how they all meet their end, and is that child used as a battering ram to brain Priam? You know, that is the child thrown off the battlements, as we see in Trojan Women, the Euripides play? Yeah, I found it incredibly moving, you know, and I like to think of myself as a cynic who is never moved, but all these stories come flooding back. And I find it a very powerful place, perhaps because it's in ruins, because one looks at the landscape and feels it to be a Homeric landscape, because it's so familiar.
That's the other thing, as well as the ruin being extraordinary, the surrounding landscape as you drive from Istanbul, the hours and hours of industrial landscape, and then suddenly it gives way to this rural landscape, which does look unchanged since 1180 BC.
Yeah, and depending on what time of year you go, when you and I went together 9 years ago, I think there are lots of spring flowers, all rather beautiful. My most recent visit in the autumn, it's different again. It it's lovely. I and yet of that they have seven, they had 700,000 visitors this year. They think, the professor thinks, that with the new museum, the reopening of the Istanbul Archaeological Museum, which has been closed for about 7 or 8 years, and with this new British Museum exhibition, that there are likely to be 1 million visitors next year. But only a fifth of these are British. So it's this very odd thing where you tell people where you've been and they say, oh, but that doesn't exist. That's not, you know, even people who've done classics at school or who did classics at university, there's still this fiction that it's a fiction. So it's strange.
And why do you think that is? Because it's such a famous supposed myth in the first place, do you think?
I think there's still associated with Schliemann this idea. Yes, perhaps it's a very successful fiction. So it's such a good fiction that we eradicate any idea of reality. It's also a Schliemann thing. I think that he was so dodgy and, you know, was always trying to sell things as things that they weren't, that people still associate it with being a fib and wishful thinking on his part. Perhaps also there is a kind of Orientalism, as people refer to it, that we know the Greek sites, but because this is the Eastern, the Trojan site, there's a kind of cultural blindness, and we can't, you know, these were Hittites, and we somehow, in our with our Greek prejudice, can't quite see it as being a real place.
And maybe until recently, the Turks themselves, for understandable reasons, weren't that proud of it. I mean, when I went there, you don't get many road signs till you're very close. But I think now there has been this big change. So this new museum opened this year by President Erdogan with huge amounts of money, that perhaps there's a greater Turkish promotion of Troy now.
Yes, and I do think it's significant that having for a long time been in the hands of Germans and Americans, now the person who's head of the dig is very much Turkish, and it feels more as if it's become part of Turkish culture rather than kind of foreign invaders having control of the dig.
And did you get a feel, there's this famous controversy over Homer as to whether he's a he, a she, or a they. Did you get any bigger feel for who actually wrote it?
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like the arguments over was Shakespeare Shakespeare. With those, I'm very much in favour of Shakespeare being Shakespeare and a grammar school boy in the Elizabethan period. The Homer thing, I mean, again, it's sort of political argument. It's an argument that some of us have grown up on one side or the other. I think there is a sense that we know what would have been available for someone called Homer to see in 720 or whatever. He would have been able to see bits of the late Bronze Age Troy. So the archaeological evidence reveals to us what was possible to see then of what was remaining for, you know, it's all terribly complicated.
Yeah.
It certainly makes you feel that it is possible for someone to have visited at that point and then not created, but boosted a tourist industry that already existed in the area. I mean, because that's one thing that is wonderful about looking at the various Troys now, is that you get to visit the tourist area, the Roman tourist area, of the ancient site. So the dig that Professor Aslan is involved with now is a 10-year project into the Roman Agora, which itself then reveals some of the late Bronze Age Troy. Is that, I mean, again, yeah. I need to refer to the floating biscuits. It does sound complicated,
your
doesn't it?
Floating biscuits are correct.
Just
yeah.
go, just go. It does all, there's a wonderful part where they've labelled different bits of Troy. So you get all the floating biscuits at once with little signs. And that suddenly makes you think, oh my God, what am I looking at? I would actually recommend I talk to the professor about, you know, do you want people to visit the museum first and then the site, or the site and then the museum? He said site, then museum. I think museum, site, museum.
I agree with you.
Because then you get a sense of what you're going into, you look at it, you fall in love, you become overwhelmed, you have all your emotional Iliad-shaped thoughts, and then you can come out again and put what you've seen in context. Oh, and I'll be going back. It's a cracker. Perhaps we'll both go and look at the Istanbul Archaeological Museum and go
to,
and take
yes.
another
yeah,
look.
Yeah. My last question, in your lovely piece, you refer to, you always ask people, which character they associate with in the Iliad to establish whether they're an idiot or a genius. What character are you?
Well, I know that you, when I first asked you over 10 years ago, you were Hector, weren't you?
I think I was Hector, yeah. But I'm now revising that because I'm far too weak to be Hector.
No.
If there was sort of
I think you're right.
Ineffectual, nervous, bald onseer in the Iliad, I can't remember.
No,
one.
You're my Hector. Yeah. You're my Hector. I identify with Cassandra always. And
because you're a journalist.
Because I'm all-knowing, because I'm omniscient and never believed. I just love her. I find...
You'll have to tell the listeners, who some of them might not know who
Cassandra
was.
Yes, of course. So Cassandra is one of Priam's daughters, fecund Priam, who has all these sons and daughters. And she is gifted, cursed, with the ability to know everything that's going to happen, but cursed in as much as no one will believe her. And so she not only goes through the fall of Troy, she knows it's coming, she knows everything that's going to happen, and she can do nothing to prevent it. So she lives in all these different realities, she experiences all at once, everyone thinks she's mad. I just find her the most intriguing figure. It's funny, there are all these contemporary novels now. Troy is in fashion again as something that people write novels about. I haven't been able to let myself read any of them, although I'm told they're brilliant, because I don't want other people's Troys in my head. So I haven't seen the film from a few years back either. I just find it so rich in my own brain that I don't really want somebody else's version in it. I don't know if that sounds selfish.
No, I completely agree. Better to go back to the original and best site. Thanks so much to Hannah Betts, for her fantastic podcast and for her terrific article in the latest Oldie magazine.